Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is Greer McAllister. Greer was raised in the Midwest. I'm curious where in the Midwest, because we're in Iowa, as many of you know. She earned her MFA in creative writing from American University. Her historical novels, including The Magician's Lie, Girl in Disguise, and The Arctic Fury, have been named Book of the Month, Indie Next, Target Book Club, Amazon Best Book, and on and on. And as G.R. McAllister, she's also the author of the Five Queendoms series, which Pace magazine called the best feminist fantasy series you probably haven't read. And I think I read somewhere else that it's, if you liked Game of Thrones, Hunger Games, that kind of thing, this is a good series for you. And the book we're talking about today is historical fiction. It's The 13th Husband. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Greer.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. And I was, in fact, raised in Iowa, so it works out very nicely. A little bit of a mini homecoming today.
Wow. Where in Iowa?
Northeastern part of the state near Cedar Falls, Waterloo.
Okay. Well, we're the southeastern part, so not too far. So how did you start writing historical fiction?
It was an accident. I was writing. I wrote a lot of different contemporary novels that were never published and probably never will be published because they were my learning process. And then I got an idea that I had seen countless things, and I think this is probably true of everyone. You see lots of things in the culture, and I had always seen magicians, stage magicians, as like men who would make rabbits, pull rabbits out of hats, make things disappear, and cut women in half. And so I thought about, okay, men cutting women in half, that's interesting. Have there been any female magicians who cut men in half as their signature illusion? And when I did some research about it, I found that the first woman who really did that was in the 1980s. And I didn't want to write a story about that set in the 1980s. I didn't want to write a story that was contemporary, because how magic used to be was it was like TV or movies or something, or podcasting now, that it was something that everybody had experience with. And it isn't that way anymore. So I wanted to write a book set at the height of stage magic as entertainment, which turned out to be vaudeville, late 1880s into 90s, up to 1900 or so. And I started writing that story, and I'm like, oh, I don't know anything about this period. I better research. And that is why it took me 5 years to write my first book, my first historical novel, because I was so busy going back and forth between writing and then researching and then writing and then researching. And I have a much better process now, but I sort of fell into it because of that idea. And then since then, I've had just a bunch of other ideas about sort of that same period.
So are all your historical fiction set in that period? Because The 13th Husband is also kind of in that same time period. So
Yeah. So they're as old as, so The Arctic Fury is sort of 1840s, 1850s. But Woman 99 is 1880s, 13th Husband is 1880s. There's something about that particular time that seems to keep pulling me back.
And it does seem to be a time that is attracting attention now with the Gilded Age TV series.
Yes. Yeah.
Are there other, a lot of other writers working in that period?
Not as many as World War II, although, every single year I hear, oh, well, World War II, we're finally done with that. And then every year, like 20 books coming out about unsung women of World War II. And some of them are absolutely fascinating. So I would never want to say like any particular period doesn't yield great fiction, because every period can yield great fiction. But it is fun to me. There are a few other people I've run across in that Gilded Age period. There's a great book about the woman who helped build the Brooklyn Bridge. She was married to the chief engineer, and when he was injured, she sort of took over. And she was actually I guess it's a spoiler for season two of The Gilded Age, but that person makes an appearance, let's just say.
Okay.
Because she was in New York at the time that that specific TV show is set. And so they incorporate real, you know, some of them are fictional characters. Bertha Russell is a fictional character, but they, you know, they're pulling in the Astors and a lot of other real people.
Yeah.
Which I find fun.
Yeah. So have you ever... So your books about that period are all based on real people?
It depends. Woman 99 was inspired by Nellie Bly, who, among many, many other things, pretended to be insane so that she could go inside an insane asylum and expose the terrible conditions at Blackwell's Island. I decided not to write actually about Nellie, but I wrote Woman 99, again, inspired by her. A character who goes undercover in an insane asylum to rescue someone that she loves was sort of a jumping, you know, using Nellie Bly as a jumping off point.
I just hope they had a surefire way to get out again.
That is the thing that you would think, you know, would be a reason to not do it.
Yes.
Because there are probably, you know, and, I mean, I could do a whole hour on the insane asylums of the 1850s through 1900, but a lot of those women were not insane. A lot of those women were inconvenient to their husbands or fathers and were put away just to get them out of the way. But there were certainly plenty of people, men and women, who were inside insane asylums and saying, I'm perfectly sane, let me out, you know, so...
Yeah,
definitely not a foolproof plan when Nellie Bly did it. She managed to get out after 10 days, thank goodness. So
I'm guessing that's part of the plot of your novel is she gets in and then how does she get back out?
Exactly. She didn't get through. She is a pampered young, young lady from a fine family in San Francisco. And she just sort of assumes that everything's going to work out for her because it always has. And it's a little more challenging than that.
Wow. So, with the 13th husband, who is the heroine of this story, or the protagonist,
yes, let's say? So, the book is fiction, but the woman was real. So, this one is definitely very much based on a real person. Her name was Amy Crocker. She was an heiress from a well-to-do California family. Her father was actually the lawyer for the Big Four who built the Transcontinental Railroad. Her uncle was one of the Big Four, and then her father was the lawyer and made quite a bit of money. And then her father died when she was 10 and left her $10 million, which is the equivalent of $300 million today. So she was a young woman with her own money, which is very, very unusual. And then what she did with it was even more unusual because she decided to travel the world and get tattoos and marry and divorce a succession of younger and younger husbands over a series of decades and do all sorts of wild stuff, fund Broadway shows and live in Japan. And she did so many things I actually had to streamline some of it because it would have made a much longer book than the one that I
I wondered about that because about midway through reading, I had to go. I was like, is all this really, is this a real person? So I went and looked her up on Wikipedia and it did seem like you stayed pretty close to, you know, the facts of what happened. And she actually wrote a memoir. So you had that to use as sort of a basis, but how come we've never heard of her? I mean, she's such an interesting character.
Really? I have that because there are certainly people of that period who were famous and well-known, and she was a tabloid fixture. I mean, people were writing about her journeys and her weight loss secrets and when her dogs got poisoned and everything, she was on the front page, but for some reason that sort of peaked and fell off. And I think you see this with a lot of women authors of the period too. If they're very, very popular, then they're not necessarily seen as refined, you know, it's in the daily newspaper, but yesterday's newspaper is gone. And today's news is today's. So, she did write that memoir, and it was successful in its time, but it wasn't the sort of thing that was going to like get taught in high school literature classes. It is a fascinating read. Her Wikipedia entry alone, as you saw, is a journey. There's a lot in there. And then her memoir is sort of a marketing exercise because she wrote it late in life and she only had to write about the parts of her life that she wanted to write about. So, for example, her first marriage, which was a huge scandal when it broke up and all sorts of things involved in that. She has about three lines in the memoir. She basically says, I got married. It didn't work out. We tried really hard, but then it was ended, then it was over. And then she just moves right on. So I used the memoir as food, but I didn't base the story overall on it because she was skimming over some of the most interesting things. Then she was telling wild stories that I could not sustain. She said she had a boyfriend in Shanghai who was the head of like a Chinese gang and tried to have her killed and accidentally killed her mate instead and all of that stuff. So I didn't put all of that in the book. Anything I found personally unbelievable was the memoir is there if people want to read it and get her perspective on things.
Now, did she write other books?
She did. She also wrote, it's sort of a book of short stories called, I believe, Moon Madness and Other Fantasies, I want to say. I don't have a copy of it right in front of me. But it was sort of these little vignettes, little stories that were kind of based on her crazy travels, but not completely biographical. So she and her publisher weren't even sure whether to call it fiction or not, but they're sort of considered stories. So those are her two works. The memoir, which I have to tell people, it's called And I Do It Again. so it's definitely
I love that. Like I love that.
It's like I said, it's a marketing exercise because it was in her best interest to really seem like a woman who lived with no regrets. And so the memoir doesn't really tell you whether she had regrets or not, but my version of Amy might have a few.
So how did you get interested in Amy Crocker?
So when I was researching The Arctic Fury, which again takes place a little bit earlier, I was trying to base the characters in the novel on real women. So again, I wasn't taking the stories of real women and following them, I was looking for women of the period doing interesting things and then took that as inspiration to build this fictional cast of women who were traveling to the Arctic, which is, again, a what-if story. There was no, as far as we know, there was no group of 12 women who went to the Arctic to look for the Lost Franklin expedition. But the Lost Franklin expedition did happen, and Lady Jane Franklin, the wife of the main guy who was leading that expedition, she did send expeditions to look for him in this vast, unmapped Arctic area. So I was looking around for women to be inspired by because the women in that period, they were climbing mountains, they were riding the California Trail, there were women married to trappers who were actually out in the wilderness. And so it was really interesting to me to use these women as a jumping off point for my characters. And my husband actually sent me a link to an article about Amy Crocker. And both of us realized she wasn't quite from the right period. She was born in the 1860s, but she didn't really get going making headlines until the 1880s. And so I sort of filed her away. And then when I was looking for historical subjects I might want to write about, I pulled her out again. And then I went on that journey in the Wikipedia. And exactly like you said, why have I never heard of this woman? This is amazing. And I really like to just sort of remind people that history is not made up of, big old groups of people that like, oh, women did this, women did that. Each individual woman made her own decisions, and a lot of them weren't free to do as they wanted, but Amy was because of her money. And she still has some limits on her life, and she has heartbreak and she has tragedy. But if she wants to, if she talks to the king of Hawaii and he says, why don't you come visit me? She can say, sure, okay, I'll come to Hawaii.
Wow. I wonder how many other women there were who lived lives kind of outside the, who were doing things that we didn't, we don't think that women of that age did. Or, you know, how many weren't following all the rules?
Yeah, I think there were plenty, and some of them sort of make it into the official historical record because of who they were, but a lot of them don't. So the women who, again, were sort of leaving everything and going to California, we'll never know, you know, how many women of that period were doing the wild things, because they're not recorded. They're not, you know,
right.
We don't have information. Rich women of the period, we do, because again, they were making headlines. And so there were definitely other women who were trying to make their own stamp in some way, with, you know, not just saying, okay, well, you know, my job is to raise children and make my husband look good. So there were women who were doing that, but there were saying, okay, well, I'm going to raise my children or pay somebody to do it. I'm going to make my husband look good, but I also want to make my own mark. And so that's where you have like an Elva Vanderbilt in New York, the women on the social scene who were just had their own complete ecosystem of things that they were doing and the people that they wanted to be.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Greer McAllister, author of The 13th Husband. So tell us about that title. Because
so this
she didn't actually get married 13 times, but
right, yeah. Yes. I tell people you've got to read it to really understand the whole thing. But it is my book that has changed titles the fewest times, which I find endlessly entertaining. So my other books have had a whole bunch of different titles just because I'm, you know, I call it something while I'm working on it. My editor might have a different idea. There might be another book in the market with a title that's too similar. You know, The Arctic Fury was called Queens of the Arctic. And then we were worried that people thought it would be like they would think it was literal queens, and it's not. So we changed things around. But while I was brainstorming with my editor about The 13th Husband and explaining the whole Amy Crocker story and how she had had sort of this interesting relationship with the supernatural, that she would talk to mediums, and that in fact she said a fortune teller had once told her that she would have 13 husbands and her 13th husband would bury her. And my editor said, oh, The 13th Husband, that's a great title. And it never changed again. The whole time, it has always been The 13th Husband from then on. So,
so she also later said something about the, even though she wasn't actually married 13 times, if she counted some, you want to explain that?
Yeah, she, I don't want to get too deep into it, but if she counts sort of the other people who have been sort of her connection, her soul, people that she's given herself to, not necessarily sexually, but in some sort of meaningful and lasting way, that could increase her overall total, which is actually something that she said in real life. It's always fun to sort of go back and even remind myself, what did I make up and what did she say? She did say that, and she did say that she had been told by a fortune teller that her 13th husband would bury her, and that she began seeing a vision of a woman in white when she was a child. And so that's something that I pulled in to make part of my story, to make it all sort of tie it together, because as fun as Amy's exploits are and as amazing as she was, and I think everybody needs to know about her, just reading, oh, Amy goes and does something crazy over and over and over again doesn't make for a like a book.
right.
So, so the woman in white and the number of husbands sort of tie it all together over the course of the book.
And really this theme, the woman in white and her sort of interest in mediums, psychics, and spiritualism, was not unusual for that age, was it?
Right. Yeah. Spiritualism was big. So it got, people got interested in debunking it a couple of decades later. But at that time, it was very popular, and it was a very typical thing for a woman to go to a medium and ask for some guidance, or for people who had had losses in their lives to go and ask somebody to reach out across the barrier, to reach to the other side and communicate with the recently dead.
Wow. I wonder, when did that, during, you know, since you're so familiar with kind of this age, when did that, the whole like seances and stuff, when did that really start to become popular, and why did it decline? When and why did it decline in popularity?
That's a good question. I'm definitely not an expert in it, but I've read certainly stories of it happening through the 1850s, I would say. Because during the, I mentioned the Franklin expedition, that's the subject of the Arctic Fury, there were, while they were looking for this lost expedition, the people who were, whose loved ones had disappeared did actually go to spiritualists and mediums and say, hey, can you, you know, help me find where these people are? Can your spirits help me find them? And there were spiritualists who claimed that they could help them find these people. And also there's another one of my books, Girl in Disguise, Kate Warren, who was a real person, who helped save Abraham Lincoln's life on his way to his inauguration, because she was a private detective. And I can go on and on about Kate, too.
What?
Kate, don't know that much about her. She sort of skims lightly over the surface of the historical record, partly because she was a detective and a spy, and they don't necessarily want their exploits in the newspaper. And she worked for the Pinkerton Agency. So the Pinkerton Agency records were kept in Chicago, because that's where the agency was based. And then in the 1871 Great Chicago Fire, most of that stuff burned up. So I was able to read the Pinkerton Agency records as they currently exist at the Library of Congress. But Kate Warren's stuff is very, very skimpy. So there are a few things. But I'm coming back around to spiritualists, because we only know like three or four cases that Kate actually worked on. But in one of them, so she, there was a man who thought that his sister and her husband were trying to poison him. And so he hired the Pinkertons to find out whether it was true. And Kate posed as a fortune teller and befriended the woman and became sort of her spiritual advisor, and found out that, in fact, she totally was trying to poison her brother. So that, again, sort of these women that had, you know, spiritualists and mediums were sort of their advisors. They would go to people and say, hey, what should I do about this? What should I do about that? You know, and so certainly the 1850s was, it was well established by then. And some of the debunking, I would say 1910s into 1920s, one of the most famous people who got very serious about debunking spiritualism was Harry Houdini. So, he was a magician. He was fooling people left and right, but he didn't like that spiritualists were doing it for money and misleading people. And he actually even had an agreement with his wife that whoever died first, they had a signal. Like if Harry Houdini died and his wife went to a medium and the medium said like a specific catchphrase or something like that, it would mean that Harry Houdini's spirit really had come back. But that never happened. He did die, and his wife checked with a couple spiritualists, and none of them knew his secret code. So it's interesting. It's like anything, right? With a rise and fall.
Yeah. So Houdini was fine with it being entertainment, exactly, but not people becoming dependent on spiritualists for advice.
Right. And for people to have that false hope or that false connection of, you know, connecting with the dead. He did not care for that. But one of the great things with illusion magic is, you know, you're being fooled, right? Like You're going to where someone is going to fool you, and you might even pay them money to fool you. And then you get fooled and you're like, oh my gosh, how did you do that? I got to learn a lot about magic when I was researching that that particular
book. I bet. So how do you know when you come across a subject like Kate, what was her last name?
Kate Warren. Mm-hmm.
Kate Warren or Amy Crocker, that this is someone you want to spend the next year or two of your life learning about and writing about.
You hit the nail on the head there. Yeah. That is because there are too many. Like, there are so many women I would love to write about, and it just keeps happening. Or somebody will send me a name and be like, you should write about this person, or you should write about my grandma, or you should, you know. I could write about any number of people. There has to be a level of complexity to it that intrigues me, right? Because, like you said, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with this person. I'm going to have to research them, write about them, and then talk about them once the book comes out. And I can't be sick of them by that point. So I'm definitely not sick of Amy Crocker. It has to be someone who I can bring something to the story. I felt like I couldn't bring anything to Nellie Bly's story. So Nellie Bly inspired me with her, you know, stunt reporter. She went into an insane asylum to expose the conditions. She traveled around the world. She made it around the world in less than 80 days solo with like one bag. It's amazing. But because she was a newspaper reporter, she wrote about those things. There are nonfiction books about her. You can read the articles that she wrote. I didn't have anything to bring to Nellie Bly's story. So if it's somebody who's really interesting, but they've already been well covered, or I just don't have an angle on it, I tried to come up with an angle for Marie Curie for years because she's absolutely fascinating. But I couldn't figure out what I could bring to that story. So when I was reading about Amy Crocker, and I sort of pieced together the idea of like, oh, what if this is the role of the woman in white? And what if this is who the 13th husband is? And what if, these pieces came together? I thought, oh, okay, I can bring something to the story of Amy Crocker. And then I have to say that to my editor and agent, and they have to, you know, a publisher has to buy it. I can come up with all the stories that I want. And I love to write, and I do it sometimes for the joy of it, but I also do it because I want readers to find these stories and get excited about them the way that I got excited about them. And so that's, you know, Amy Crocker had that energy, the Arctic Fury, this story of what if these women had done this, that had that energy. And so that's sort of how I decide if it's my subject or not.
Okay. So in the 13th husband, I'm curious about whether, you know, what you made up and what was true in a sense. And it seemed like most of it was based on truth, but of course what she was really thinking and feeling at the time, you had to make some conjecture on that. But the little bit related to the Titanic, was that true?
Yes. Yeah. I found that in the historical record that she had to
wow.
the Titanic and did not, which wasn't super unusual at the time. The rich people really wanted it. It was the maiden voyage. The rich people who were in Europe and wanted to get to the US were like, ooh, this is a really cool way to do this. Let's buy tickets. And then I tweaked a little bit from what the record had stated about why she didn't get on. But I felt like I needed to include that. Wildest stuff is the stuff that's real. I would not, in a completely fictional novel, I could never have gotten away with the idea that she gets into a train wreck on her honeymoon. That this marriage that will, in fact, go off the rails starts with a train literally going off the rails. Like that would be too on the nose for my editor. But because it actually happened, I was able to put it in the book. And so the author's note at the end really spells out, this happened, this did not happen, this we don't know whether it happened. Amy claimed that she was told this by a fortune teller, but how would we know, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So the idea of truth being as slippery as it is in general, is what it is. But I did try to document very clearly in my author's note, which is at the end, because spoilers.
Right.
But
right.
to document, yes, this is drawn from the historical record, and no, this is not. Or I moved this over there. Because I feel like in finding the line in historical fiction, you know, some history, some fiction, I want readers to have the best possible experience while they're reading the book. But I know that people also do want to know what's real and what's not at the end of it.
So I'm also, you know, curious about what happened to the people in her life after she moved on from the either from them or after she died. You know, her like Porter Ashe, whatever happened to him?
Oh, gosh. He died. And I have it in my research. And my husband did this amazingly helpful timeline for me because we read all these books, nonfiction accounts and Wikipedia entries and little highlight reels of Amy. But then it's hard to figure out, like, okay, what year did this thing happen? And then and how did they fit in with each other? So he went off in his own direction after they divorced. And I can't remember off the top of my head, but he definitely, you know, he continued his own wild ways because he was also not exactly a wallflower. But it was funny because I had a virtual event the other day with a bookstore in Asheville, North Carolina. So I actually got to bust out the Porter Ashe's family helped found Asheville, and that's why it's called Asheville because it was the Ashe family. So like your hometown boy, except like he was not a nice man, but that, you know, but still, if we held everybody in history to the highest of standards, we would have to wipe out most of history. So we can at least know what they did and talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I noted that Amy had a nickname in the press of Queen of Bohemia.
Yes. That
and
among others.
Where did that come from? And what does that actually, what was Bohemia back then?
So Bohemia literally was an area in Europe. I believe it was in Germany. But it became this idea of wildness, that Bohemian lifestyle was the people who were just living it up. And you didn't necessarily have to have money. And in fact, some people believed that you couldn't be a true Bohemian if you did have money. But it sort of became this byword for the wild lifestyle, for fun and artistic and lively, as opposed to the very formal and correct type of society. So she, because she was wild and artistic and having fun, was called by one of the newspapers the Queen of Bohemia, because she was a particular type of royalty in those days.
Now, she inherited $10 million mm-hmm. when she was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, even though that was a lot of money, you could still lose a lot of money. People had, you know, if you don't know what you're doing and you let people take advantage of you and you invest in wild things, it's possible to go through a fortune even of that size at that time. Did she manage her own money?
So she had access to it largely. I think she must have had some help with it. And she had different amounts of access at different times, depending on whether she was married or not and who she was married to, because women certainly did not have full access to their own money. They couldn't have bank accounts or anything. So it was always like semi-managed. But my understanding is she was making the decisions largely about investments and things like that. And she and her mom and her sister Jenny all got $10 million. And each of them used it in slightly different ways. The mother and Jenny were much more traditional, philanthropic, let's give some of it away, let's, you know, endow homes for unwed mothers and things like that. The Crocker Art Museum, a lot of Amy's mom's money went in that direction. But Amy did not do that. She did have some pet causes. She certainly was very supportive of artists. But supporting artists is a relatively inexpensive way to spend versus, you know, buying a silver mine in Nevada that ends up, you know, not having any silver in it. Right. She did.
Right.
Investments. My impression is that she wasn't trying to dramatically increase her money. So she wasn't gambling. She hated gambling. Porter Ashe was a gambler. And so he went through, quite a bit of her money in their marriage, but their marriage didn't last that long, so he was not able to get through all of it in that limited amount of time. So my understanding is that she may not have died with a whole lot of money because she did go through a lot of it, but during her lifetime she had what she needed
and lived well.
Yes.
So, Greer, why don't you read a little bit from The 13th Husband for us?
Sure. Let me pull this up. And I will just start at the very beginning because I think it's it's easiest. Then I don't have to do any description of what comes before. Because the only thing that comes before this first little bit is a quote from Amy that I like to start with. And all of the quotes that each of the chapters in The 13th Husband starts with a quote from Amy, and those are actual quotes from either a newspaper article or her own writings. So the one that starts the book is, that's about all we get out of life, rich or poor, isn't it? A few hours of enjoyment here and there. I think it is folly to allow a single chance for pleasure to slip past you. So she was quoted as saying that in 1911. So then we'll start with the very beginning. You know, don't you, that I've been fighting this nearly my entire life? I don't expect sympathy, of course, from you or anyone. There's been precious little of that, certainly none from the tabloid press. People think the rich don't struggle, and I understand why. Money solves so many problems, opens so many doors. That's why I held on to mine instead of giving it away. It was the only power I could count on. Because I was so very rich at almost any point in my life, when I wanted to go somewhere, I went. For a woman in these times, that was no small thing. But with the tabloids dogging my steps, painting me with their scarlet brush in my very girlhood, I had my own struggles. The press called me wild, among other things. They were outraged by the notion of a woman determined to make her own choices. They labeled me an adventuress, a hussy, a known menace. Even when the Philadelphia Inquirer loudly proclaimed me the Queen of Bohemia, it wasn't entirely a compliment. And when I'm dead, they'll trumpet my husband's names in the headlines as if my marriages were all that mattered. I am more than gold bands and paperwork. Of course, there are men in my story, some would say an unseemly number. There's love and scandal, heartbreak and poison, passion and deceit. It takes place in courtrooms and orphanages, palaces and temples, in Hawaii and Tokyo and the world around. And in my story, there are also questions, so many questions, one of which you are the answer to. The three things that have haunted me all these decades are simple enough to name: the tabloids, the Spanish fortune teller's prophecy, and the woman in white. Where to begin? Not at the beginning. That would be expected. And you know as well as anyone, doing the expected was never my style. Let's start instead in the middle. I arrived in Spain fresh off the boat from Hawaii, 23 years old and reeling from my first divorce, in search of a woman I didn't know was already dead. What had happened in Hawaii had scared me badly, made me think about a reckoning. Not that I believed in the musty Christian vision of heaven and hell, but if I were to find myself at those much written about pearly gates, where would I fall short? What did I regret leaving undone? So when the captain of my chartered vessel asked me for my next destination, I thought about the who had once been kind to me at a low moment, and I said, Madrid. Captain Judd knew me well. He knew the contents of my passbook even better. So rather than deride me for naming a landlocked city, he said, would you prefer to go via Lisbon, Bilbao, or Barcelona? I pictured the map of Europe I recalled so clearly, rugged brown coastlines nudging up against the blue of oceans and seas. Bilbao, I think. A good choice. Even with no interest in the captain beyond the professional, I flirted a bit. Would you tell me if you thought it was a poor choice? His smile was genuine. I would not. We cabled ahead to Bilbao to have arrangements made for docking the Tropic Star and my travel beyond. With so many messages flying back and forth, so much to manage, I got on the train before realizing my letter to the Contessa had gone unanswered. At the Burgos stop, I sent telegrams to make other inquiries. When I arrived in Madrid, the bad news was waiting for me. The Contessa had passed away the previous year. Another traveler might have cursed herself for coming all this way without arranging things more firmly beforehand, but I've never been that kind of traveler. In my view, why not go? I needed to be somewhere. Madrid was as good as any other place and better than most. Besides, most women of that age, this was back in 1888, remember, never traveled without husbands or households in tow. A woman alone was viewed with suspicion. Society's rules defined the ideal woman of those days as one who made her family her entire purpose for being, their care her highest calling. So is it any wonder I never fit in? After settling my things in an elegant, comfortable chamber at the Grand Hotel, I thought about what I most wanted to do. In a foreign country where I knew no one, with time and money no object, what should be my first step? I changed into my plainest gown, secured my valuables in the hotel safe, and went in search of a local fortune teller. Spiritualism was still all the rage, the debunking crusades of the 1920s not yet a glimmer in a cynical Houdini's eye. In the 1880s, if a divorced woman and a medium sat in a room together, the medium was the less suspect of the two. The palm reader I found on that day in Madrid was of the mysterious and handsome school, which I'd found only slightly less common worldwide than the toothless and disreputable type. His skin and hair were dark, his fingers long and delicate, his receiving room full of fragrant flowers with waxy leaves that transported me right back to that night in the orangerie with the doomed beautiful Miguel. I was journeying straight into the memories I'd once fled from. I thought I was being brave. I have found out since that bravery and foolishness are easy to mistake for one another. Once I sat down across from the table from him and paid his fee, modest considering, the handsome Spanish fortune teller asked me, "Very well, what is your name?" "Why do you need to know that?" I shot back, perhaps a little more aggressively than needed. "Shouldn't we remain strangers? The less you know, the more impressive I'll find it when you tell my future." He shook his head. "I have few questions, but I need something to call you. Any name will do." I made a snap decision. "You may call me Miss Crocker." "Very well, Miss Crocker. Your hand?" I presented it, and he drew the palm toward him, lowering his face almost close enough to kiss it. I felt his breath in my hand as he looked, following lines, turning the entire hand to examine it from every angle. Finally, I said, "Enough looking. What do you see?" In a steady voice, nothing too dramatic, he said to me, "Ah, you need to be careful about getting married." My response was quick and sharp, my pain still fresh. "Tell me something I don't know." Perhaps my sarcasm was lost in translation. He may not have been familiar with the American phrase. In any case, his eyes met mine, and the next words out of his mouth were surprising indeed. Teeth bared in a tight, threatening smile, the palm reader said, "Miss Crocker, you will have 13 husbands. The 13th will bury you." A sharp, icy shiver went up the back of my neck. I held myself still so he wouldn't see it, and I said, sounding like I could take a joke, "Well, I didn't know that."
That's a great place to stop. Thank you, Greer. That was Greer McAllister reading from The 13th Husband. Do you think if you had known Amy Crocker, you would have liked her?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I didn't. Every once in a while, something surprises me after a book comes out. And so somebody said, you know, "Oh, I feel like she's not that likable. Did you get any pressure to make her more likable?" And I said to myself, like, is she likable? Is she not likable? She makes a lot of terrible decisions, but don't we all? So I found her very interesting. I think there are some things that I love about her. So I think particularly for the time in which she had what we would consider a pretty modern outlook about international travel and other cultures, she would travel to these places, and she had that sort of bent toward, I don't want to be a tourist. I want to go live among the people and do what they do and understand them better because I am trying to be one of them, with the understanding you never can truly, but you learn more about other cultures by immersing yourself in them and not just going and pointing at the, you know, the tallest mountain in Japan. So I love that about her. I think that was really good. I think she could have been a little bit smarter about her love affairs, and particularly the way that she tells things in her memoir, And I'd Do It Again, she's just falling left and right for like a whole bunch of terrible men. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Whether that's part of the legend that she wanted to do. But if I had been her friend, I would have definitely had some advice to give her about just to hold on and like don't jump right into this.
The really horrible romance in Hawaii.
Yeah.
How was that? Did that, you know, with a hypnotist basically?
Yes.
Who was controlling her? How did she write about that in her memoir? And
she did. She did. Yeah. She said she was absolutely horrified by this man and yet at the same time compelled by him because he had hypnotized her and she was unable to break away from him. So that is all from how she tells it. So, again, not sure whether it was true or not, but it was what she said. And the fact that that person existed, that he did go to Hawaii, no spoilers, but that he did die in the way that he dies in the book. That is, it is very yucky and it is very true. So for people to have something to look forward to, with Washington Irving Bishop, but he was a real figure of the period and he did make his fame working for a woman who said she trafficked in the other side and then, debunking her stuff to make himself more famous. That's all historical record. He's a really interesting guy.
Now, why did you choose not to include all of her adopted children in the story?
I feel like it was just a lot to keep track of already for the for the reader. I think she had a couple of sisters too in her family that I didn't include. People died off early. There was a cousin that lived with her family. There were just the population of her life was much bigger than I could realistically expect readers to keep track of. I felt like it was important to include some of her adoption journey, especially with what happens to her daughter with Porter Ash. And then she and one of her husbands, I won't say which one, decide that they want to expand their family through adoption. Actually happen, and so I included those children as part of the narrative because it made sense within the context of the story. But there were some later on that I did not include because again I just felt like it was asking the reader to keep track of people without having a great reason. Like I said, the ones that she adopted with name redacted were very much part of her of the arc of the character that I wanted to talk about.
Right, right. Did she talk about her like maternal feelings or lack thereof? You know, do you feel like you got a good read on her in that way?
Not really. I mean, that was so lightly included in her memoir. She talks almost like she basically acknowledges that the first marriage happened, that the daughter was born as part of that, but then doesn't talk at all about how she felt about what happened to that daughter. And I think she does talk some about adopting children and welcoming them into the family. But she certainly doesn't go deep on it. And so I had to sort of project and imagine and fill in some things about her connection to her daughter, to all of her children, adopted or otherwise.
Did any of them write about her?
I haven't seen any of it. They may have. But I haven't seen any of
it. It'd be interesting to know what they thought about this amazing woman who was their mother, but was so out there in the world.
Right, right.
In such an unusual way.
Yeah.
But I love that she was willing to sort of flout all the rules, but in some sense, and maybe this isn't, she comes across as being self-centered in some ways, or even selfish, because self-centered isn't necessarily a bad thing, but even a little bit selfish. Is that how you saw her?
Somewhat. I think it's a double-edged sword, the idea of if you have enough money, you can do anything. And then what is your guiding star besides, like she says, not allowing a single chance for pleasure to slip past you? What are you trying to do with your life? Is the only thing that you want to have as much fun as possible? Or is there some other reason to live? Is there some other mark that you want to leave? So I think, I think the way that I wrote her, she was pretty focused on her own pleasure and joy and interests, rather than those of other people.
Tell us a little bit about her Buddhism.
Yeah, so that was an interesting turn that she, when she traveled to India, she got very interested in Buddhism and made that sort of her focus for a while. And from then on, she had every house that she lived in, she had a room full of Buddha statues that she would go and sort of meditate in and commune in. I don't know if she ever, I'm trying to think if this is in the record, whether she officially converted to Buddhism or not, because I think that she had sort of her own spin on it, the way that she had her own spin on a lot of things. But that was one of the things that brought her together with her third husband, was that he had also had a very strong interest in Buddhism. So that is definitely in the record, that was something that she was passionate about from her travels, that she had sort of absorbed what she felt the best lessons of Buddhism were for her.
So Greer, you talked earlier on about how with your first historical novel, you spent 5 years because you were going back and forth, research, write. What is your process like now?
It is still a mess, but somewhat less so. So the messy part is the writing now, but I have a very set way of going about historical novels now, that I do a bunch of research up front. So it might be 3 months of research or more, gathering everything that I can on the individual. And if it's not about an individual, like when I researched the Arctic Fury, I read so many different books, so many firsthand accounts of men who had been exploring the Arctic in this period and sort of what they saw and where they went and that sort of thing. With Amy, it was just read everything on Amy. And her family actually has cooperated with a nonfiction writer named Kevin Taylor out in California on writing down a lot of Amy stories. And so I read those. I read everything I could get my hands on about her. And so once that was done, then I sat down to write a draft of the book. Then, so I incorporate a lot of the research, but there's still more to be done after that. So research and then write and then research again once I know what the shape of the book is. And so I, give it to my agent, give it to my editor, give it to some beta readers, figure out, okay, yes, these scenes are staying in, these scenes are not, sort of incorporate their thoughts. And then I do another round of research to sort of finalize things, to say, oh, okay, yes, this did happen in this year. Oh no, I messed it up. This person was, not born yet in this scene where I have them showing up and that kind of thing. So I find that the detail research has to be done after I've already written the book. But I don't interrupt my writing in order to go find details anymore. And
that's really interesting. So now, are you writing full time?
I am now, besides driving my children places. it takes up a lot of time, but I can, I can drive somewhere and then park and write in the car. But yes, I was full-time employed on top of writing novels until last year. Now I'm able to just be full-time writing / momming / taking care of a dog kind of stuff, with a little bit of freelance on the side. But I definitely have not been full-time writing all along. I think that you can find jobs, at least I could find a job that didn't sap away my creative energy. I had tried to teach and write at the same time, and it sapped my creative energy too much. So I found a writing job that did not sap my creative energy. And I did that for decades. So.
And what made you decide to take the step of writing full time?
It's something that my husband and I had been talking about for a while, and just the timing kind of worked out with some other things that were going on in my life. But we're able to be very lucky to not need to be doing the full-time work on top of trying to write novels and drive my kids places.
Now, does it put more pressure on you to feel like you must produce now?
That was part of why I didn't want to let go of the day job until now.
Because right.
It really is a luxury to say, I want to write a book. I'd love to write a book, but I don't have to get it done in a short amount of time in order to put food on the table. So that's what the gift of the day job was, is to say, okay, I can keep providing for myself. I can keep contributing to my family's well-being at the amount that I have been, regardless of, you cannot control publishing. No matter how fast I write, if I can't sell the book to a publisher or make the leap into self-publishing, which I have not done, it's my schedule is not completely in my control on the publishing side.
How did you first get published? How did you find your publisher?
So I found my agent with a book that has not been published. So I had gotten offers of representation on a manuscript. Actually, no, I didn't get offers. I had written a book that was good enough for several agents to say, I can't represent this, but send me the next thing that you write. And so I sent them the next thing that I wrote, which was The Magician's Lie. And I had several agents who were willing to represent that. So it was sort of this climb up to from standard rejections to positive rejections to this is still a rejection, but we like you. This is still a rejection, but you write really well. Write something different. Let me know. And so I climbed that over years after I got my MFA. And I actually even had, the novel that I wrote as my MFA thesis, I got an agent with, but they weren't able to sell it. So many rejections, so many, ups and downs over the year before The Magician's Lie was finally published. So it's it is not a business for those who are into instant gratification, right?
And do you go back and forth between writing fantasy and historical fiction, or?
I have been the last few years. So I had just been writing historical, and then I got this bug in my ear about Game of Thrones and how it would be so much better if it were all queens and no kings. and I figured somebody else must have written that, but then I had read a ton of fantasies when I was younger and then sort of drifted away from it. But when I went back to try to catch up on what had been going on with fantasy, there are tons of matriarchal worlds, but they tend to be either utopian, like, oh, women are in charge and everything's fantastic, or dystopian, like, oh, women are in charge and everything's worse than ever. And I didn't want to do either of those. I wanted it to be women are in charge. And always have been. And some of them are terrible people and some of them are wonderful people. And let's just have this big splashy swords and sorcery fantasy world where it just makes you think about our world a little bit differently because it is so female positive and female default. And it's just a different way of looking at the world. So two of those books are out. My next book that comes out will actually be a fantasy this time next year.
Fantastic. Well, Greer, thank you so much for being with us today, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. We always close with the quote, and this is what I found for Amy's book, or your book about Amy Crocker. This is from Katharine Hepburn. If you obey all the rules, you miss all the fun.
Amy would have loved it.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.